This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series. Hello and welcome to Hot Pursuit, part of Ahval video and podcast series. We are here today to talk about Turkey, its story in 2020, and possible openings for Turkish story into 2021. My guest is Professor Hamit Bozarslan from School of Social Studies based in Paris, in short, EHES. Welcome, Hamit.
Thank you.
Well, you are my guest often here in Hot Pursuit. And today we are to talk about what sort of year 2020 was for Turkey in general, domestic politics, also foreign policy issues, its sociology, its polarization. It has been an epicenter of many developments. Great, interesting story, but very sad story also in many aspects. Let's start from domestic parts, domestic aspects. What happened in 2020 in general with the bird's eye?
What happened in 2020? I think that the foregoing processes of 2018-19, they have continued actually. They have been to some extent radicalized too. These processes, they were processes of paramilitarization of Turkey, the paramilitarization also of the Turkish economics, maybe not paramilitarization, but at the same time, the formation of some kleptomanic structures around the Erdogan regime, the consolidation of a cartel composed by different political forces or paramilitary forces like MHP and the pro-Russian, pro-Putin sections of the society and of the army, probably too. What happened in 2020?
That's what you call cartel state. Repeatedly.
Cartel state, yes.
Yes.
What happened in 2020? That was also the pursuit or the continuation of the management of social management, social engineering through crisis, internal crisis, external crisis in the Caucasus, of course, but also in Libya, but also in the Eastern Mediterranean. And at the same time, I think that what happened in 2020 was the emergence of a very massive social fatigue within the society. And this social fatigue can be explained by different factors, the economic factor, of course. And we saw that the Erdogan theory of interest rates provoking inflation has collapsed totally. And Turkey is today one of the countries where money renting is at the higher cost. What happened was the COVID crisis and the coronavirus crisis, and this crisis has showed that the government has deliberately lied to its own population. So I think that we saw a lot of things, but all these things mean that the Erdogan regime is still there, but at the same time, probably the Erdogan regime is a little bit weaker, or at least its policy of managing the society through crisis has reached a point of saturation.
Mm. And that is what one sees at one level, but on many other levels, the Erdogan-Bahçeli alliance continued to take very firm, decisive steps in terms of ultra-centralization of the management, the administration. Also, at what many critics see as stripping off the major components of the judiciary. And also strengthening of the security apparatus with many steps. Also putting more and more pressure on social media, in the internet, also television channels, which is the major venue for informing the public, the most important one. And also its challenges to the European judicial system has become more apparent, challenging European Court of Human Rights, for example, and also by issuing an amnesty, which meant political prisoners staying in prisons while common criminals were being released, and also organized crime leaders being more and more outspoken and threatful to the main opposition, CHP, and other components of the opposition. All these things have been happening at the same time. Yes, it's social fatigue. Yes, it's mismanagement or collapse of certain theories on economic management, etc. But we are still seeing a very, from the outside outlook, quite solid, strong regime.
The regime is for a while being stronger. And I think that you are absolutely right. 2020 was a year of massive repression, and to some extent, a kind of surrealistic repression. And this repression means clearly that the government or the regime and its components want to address to the internal public opinion, to the society, broadly speaking, that they are boundless, that they are they will know absolutely no limit, they can go much farther, that they have no juridical restriction, that they are not bound to any kind of law, neither internally nor externally, that their will is the will of the nation, that they represent along the nation, and they will decide what is necessary for the nation. And at the same time, I think that through that, they also try to destroy the society as a meaningful body, as a body that can discuss about its past, its future, its present, that can read through a plural way its own past, that can project itself in the future. The society has no more any kind of landmark, and these landmarks are destroyed. Landmarks in time are destroyed. Landmarks in space are destroyed. When you take, for instance, what happened with the COVID crisis, this COVID crisis, the truth has been hidden. But at the same time, the chamber of the doctors, of the physicians, has been accused of betraying the nation. Erdogan explained a couple of times that was the time of reforms in the juridical field. And at the same time, he repeated again and again that Kavala and Demirtas will never be released because they are associated to terrorism or they are described as terrorists. Erdogan has explained the time has come that Turkey finds its place and her place in Europe. And at the same time, when you read what he exactly said, that was the following: we want to be a part of Europe, but since we have explained that, now it is time that Europe capitulates totally beyond other before us. So I think that you have that kind of limitless repression, and at the same time, that kind of limitless destruction of the society. And today you can say that the society has become a kind of a surrealistic body, understanding a lot of things, but not reacting so much. And that's a resource for the Erdogan regime. I mentioned the social fatigue, and actually we know that the social fatigue can be a resource, a political resource, a resource of durability for many regimes. We saw that by the past in the Arab world, in many parts of the Arab world, the authoritarian regimes have used the social fatigue as a way of managing the society. We see that clearly in the Russian case. The Putin regime uses the Russian social fatigue as a source of durability. A social fatigue means that at the same time, the people can be angry, can understand what happened, but they are not anymore able to create a political alternative. They are not anymore able to contest. They are not anymore able to create spaces of exchange, spaces of discussion, spaces of elaboration of the new meanings that everybody is unhappy, but at home, alone, or in a very limited circle. And I see that what happens in Turkey is today is that the social fatigue is there, and social fatigue means that it becomes extremely difficult to create a social movement, a political movement, a political alternative that can challenge the Erdogan regime or its components.
So its advancement will continue in this case as into the direction that it desires.
Of course. I think that you have a kind of a radicalization, but at the same time, this radicalization might also reach a point of saturation, because how long time you can go through this management. Some regimes, they can deal with that. We know that, for instance, the Putin regime, the Islamist regime of the Mullah in Iran, they could deal with that. But in some other cases, like in Tunisia in 2011, or in Egypt in 2011, at one point, all the picture can collapse at once. But it is, of course, absolutely impossible to predict what kind of scenario will take in Turkey. For while being, I think that the regime is not threatened. But at the same time, as I said, people cannot trust anymore, as it did a couple of years ago, on its government. 3 years ago, 4 years ago, you still had a kind of enthusiasm in the society.
Yes.
When there was a crisis with the Netherlands, for instance, you could have hundreds of thousands of people in the streets. When there was a crisis with United States, people were in the street and destroying their iPhone or burning the $1
bills.
Today, you have a crisis with France, and you have 300-500 people in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
Even for Karabakh, which has been presented as the Turkish national cause, there was not so much enthusiasm. For instance, the Erdogan regime insists on the fate of the Muslims in France, presented as absolute victims, as martyrs of an anti-Islamic regime. But at the same time, everyone knows that no one in the government or among the allies of government says one single word concerning Xinjiang and the Uyghurs.
Mm.
So that kind of contrast, they are more and more visible today. I think that we cannot say anymore that there is a massive enthusiasm for the regime. The regime's hegemonic bloc is not collapsed. The cartel structure is still there. But at the same time, compared to a couple of years ago, the enthusiasm, the social enthusiasm, is not anymore there. And just one example. Turkey of two years ago, Turkey's national income, global national income, was around $1 billion. Today, that's only around $750 million. And you see that the people, that there is a process of pauperization.
You mean $1 trillion to $750 billion? You said million.
So no, billion, sorry.
Billion, yes. Okay. To round up with another question, I think everybody, when I say everybody, many people are wondering. I think that was the main question mark that we had during 2020 when we observed these acts and moves and decisions. And there was, for example, one hugely symbolic act and decision to reconvert Hagia Sophia into a mosque, and also Hora Kariye into a mosque, which caused a lot of reactions and trauma in Orthodox world, etc. But that aside, in general, foreign policy, Hagia Sophia was also a foreign policy issue in many ways. A lot of people were asking this question. Is Turkey going to anchor off completely from the West in terms of what I think some analysts call de-Westernization, de-Westernization of Turkey, and what I sometimes call Eurasianization of Turkey, that Turkey is becoming a sort of Eurasian entity, and neither completely in East, nor completely in the West. And also behind closed doors, watching all these radical steps, a lot of decision makers and politicians in West talked about the rock state structure when they talked about Turkey. And some other people mentioned growing solitude of Turkey in the region and foreign policy, in the world in general. All these things, what do they tell us? Is Turkey completely, by challenging Council of Europe, by being sanctioned by European Union, by coming face-to-face with the upcoming Biden administration, with its ally, United States of America, have we seen first signs of this anchoring off completely, that we will see maybe completion of it in 2021? In terms of that, where is Turkey heading?
I think that Turkey can be defined today as a rock state. No doubt about that. It is not the only country, but Turkey is one of these countries or regimes acting as a rock state internally and externally. And the fact that the regime had so systematically so many crises with almost everybody shows it clearly. Concerning the second question, I think that this question is still not over. We don't have enough elements to see what the future of Turkey will be. It is obvious that many components of the cartel state in Turkey, they are profoundly anti-Western. They are anti-American. They hate what they call the Atlantic civilization. And the Atlantic civilization for them is the Enlightenment. That's the liberalism that they deem as corrupted. The Atlantic civilization for them is threatening Turkey, a Turkish historical mission, which consists to dominate the world. So they are absolutely anti-American, anti-European. And as I said, the anti-Europeanism or anti-Americanism is not because they are anti-imperialist, but because they are profoundly anti-liberal and anti-enlightenment. You can compare their attitude with the Japanese anti-imperialism of the 1920s and 1930s. Japan explained during this period that Asia was another civilization and that the Japan had to be the master of Asia, and the Japanese anti-imperialism was based on the claim that Japan has to be imperialist in its own territory, in its own zone.
In its own terms, yes.
Yeah, and so I think that today, Turkish anti-imperialism is not going beyond that. That's exactly the same thing. That has nothing to do with the anti-imperialism that we could see, for instance, in Asia or in Latin America or in Africa in the 1960s and 1970s. And many of Erdogan's discourse actually is about that too. When Erdogan explains that the First World War is not finished, not over yet, that the decisive battles of this great war will are yet to come, I think that he expresses very clearly what he has in mind. And that's very strange. When Erdogan speaks about the First World War, he never speaks about Russia, while the principal reason of entering to the war, that was the will to take a revenge on Russia. So the Russia is exempted, while that was the first battles they have been with Russia and France and Great Britain are accused them. So I think that there is this kind of very, very anti-liberal anti-European and anti-American attitude, which is a part of the Erdoganist ideology. And when you read what Erdogan, have in mind what Erdogan read in the 1970s, and that was around 10 books, all of these books, they were about the Western plots, conspiracy, etc., etc. So I said, here you have a kind of legacy, and at the same time, you might have something pragmatical, because economically, Turkey depends not on Russia, but still on the Western countries.
European Union.
European Union. Russian economy is weaker than the Italian economy. Russia will probably never be able to give any kind of economic assistance. Mm-hmm. China has its own imperialist projections and policies. And when you see that China has not given anything to Turkey during the last years, in spite of Erdogan's silence on the Uyghur case. So it is very, very difficult to imagine that Turkey will find any kind of economic prosperity or at least stability through an alliance with Russia and with China. So what will be the policy? Will there be some sanctions, American sanctions or European sanctions, economic sanctions against Turkey? We know from the case of 2018 that the slightest American sanctions had devastating consequences on the economy. So on the other side, you have still this pragmatic input. And it is very difficult to know what the attitude of Turkey, of Erdogan, will be between the ideological commitment, the ideological radicalism, and the pragmatic need of Turkey. But we know that some countries, some regimes, they are also able to destroy their own economy for the sake of ideological commitment or for the sake of hostility or enmity with other countries. We saw that in the history, we see that today in a country like in Iran. We cannot definitely exclude not either that Erdoganism adopts or opts for such a policy. But it is really very too early to predict what will happen in 2021 or 2022. 2021 will probably be a decisive year.
Decisive year. Yes, it's an open chapter. And then that brings us to the final question. Do we see any silver lining, any ray of hope for the opposition's role in terms of returning to normalization, some form of normalization or democratization? Do you see any hope in 2021?
For while being not, because I think that Erdogan, to some extent, is an hostage of his allies, but because he wanted that.
His allies within the state, you mean?
Yes.
The shadow state or in the deep state or inner state.
Cartel state, whatever you can imagine. And at the same time, I see that the opposition is in the situation of hostage of Erdogan. The opposition does not dare to contest Erdogan's foreign policy. The opposition does not dare to contest Erdogan's obsession or repressive policy vis-à-vis the Kurds. The opposition cannot see or cannot be able to say that the Kurdish issue is the main issue of democratization in Turkey. In order to democratize Turkey, the Kurdish issue has to be resolved pacifically, politically, and pacifically through the integration of the Kurdish actors, full integration of the Kurdish actors, and to some kind of negotiation and status, a separate distinct status. The opposition is so scared about all these issues that it remains silent, and the more it remains silent, the more it becomes difficult for it to distinguish itself from the government, from the regime.
Mm-hmm. In terms of Erdogan's pattern of ruling the country, we saw this basic motto, use, abuse, and throw away. Use, abuse, and throw away. This was the way he used his alliances in these 20 years. Is it possible in terms of 2021? You talked about pragmatism, need for pragmatism in order to save his power position. Do you think any kind of last option, because this is the last potential ally Erdogan has, CHP, any kind of grand coalition between AKP and CHP, is it likely?
It is very difficult to answer to this question, but please let me to remind that by the past, the allies that Erdogan had, they were not strong allies. Fethullah Gulen had some influences within the state, within the police structure, within the justice, and at the same time, Fethullah Gulen had absolutely no social basis at all. That was an elite movement, and as an elite movement, it always declined to have a partisan structure or a social basis. Erdogan at one point negotiated with the Kurds, but the Kurds had no military power. The PKK has a guerrilla power, of course, but this military power is a very limited one, and in any case, cannot threaten the regime. While now, when you read and when you see what happens in Turkey, the MHP has a military power because it controls the paramilitary structures that have been created since 3 or 4 years within the police and within the gendarmerie. The narrow street police that has been created and has been offered huge competences, the famous Bekçis.
District they, guards or whatever they may call it.
District guards. They have access to
weapons,
military, the important resources of violence. The generals that they present themselves as close to Eurasia, they, of course, have huge access access to huge military power and resources of violence. So I think that the situation is very different. But at the same time, once again, Erdogan maybe tomorrow will think that its space of maneuver is too far too narrowed by his allies and try to get rid of them. But I think that the situation is, for him at least, the situation is much more dark than
precarious.
Precarious than when it was when he was allied with Fethullah Gulen.
So there are difficulties ahead. In short, for Erdogan in 2021. Professor Hamit Bozarslan, thank you very much for this conversation.
My guest thank you was
my guest was Professor Bozarslan from Paris School of Social High School of Social Studies, EHES, and maybe perhaps we should end with wishing our viewers and listeners a happy, prosperous year, or a better year at least compared to 2020, which was an annus horribilis, as everyone knows.
You can follow Ahval News online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.